Welcome to this special presentation by Marshall Masters, a former CNN science feature producer and the publisher of the Colburn Bible. You can learn more about this 3,600-year-old secular wisdom text at colburn.com. That's K-O-L-B-R-I-N.com.
Living in today's modern industrial societies means that the time-honored tradition of going out in the evening to look up at the night sky has become a scheduled event. After all, we have busy lives, the perpetual distraction of television, and of course, the light pollution of our brightly lit electrified cities. Consequently, when we do find time for a look, we're usually searching for something specific, such as a lunar eclipse or a meteor shower. Yet in ancient times, our ancestors would spend hours contemplating the holistic majesty of the Creator's handiwork. Back then, they asked the same questions we often ask today. What is the everything of everything? How did it all come to be, and what is my place in it? These are the very questions that make us wonder about God. Given that the ancients did not have the benefit of space telescopes, most of their answers to these questions used simplistic metaphors of great turtles, trees, and other such recognizable physical manifestations. We've come a long way since then, and today we know, or at least we think we know, that the everything that is everything began with an event called the Big Bang, the result of which is a flat universe that is expanding. We're fairly certain of these things, but as to the future, we're not so sure. What if gravity does cause the universe to eventually collapse back in on itself? Does that prove God was created by the Big Bang and is therefore as mortal as we are? Conversely, if the universe continues to expand, does that prove it was created by God? And further assuming that it will continue to expand, what will it eventually expand into? An unimaginable nothingness beyond our universe, devoid of dimensions and time? Or on the other hand, is our universe one small part of an evolving multiverse? One so vast and unimaginable that only God could know it. And if this is so, then do we view ourselves as insignificant little specks in the grand scheme of things? Or are we the very stuff of God, and therefore rare and precious beyond measure? These are virtually impossible questions for modern-day cosmologists to answer, because they hit philosophical breaking points literally from the get-go. This is because they are doing something that's akin to a sightless person trying to understand an elephant for the first time. All that you can know is that which you happen to grope at any one moment. Consequently, any honest cosmologist will tell you that despite our vast technological prowess and all of our right-sounding theories, we only understand about 1% of the universe. The other 99% still eludes us, and will continue to do so for quite some time. This is because of the scientific process itself. Modern science only believes that which we can test and measure using our 5 physical human senses. For this reason, modern science has a mechanistic, closed-system view of the universe. This explains why we continually make new discoveries that explode previously held scientific beliefs. Or in other words, what modern science knows is that which it learns by blindly groping the elephant of the universe. The ancients did not limit themselves in such ways. Like modern scientists, they also tested and measured the world about them using their 5 physical human senses. The difference is that they didn't limit themselves. Rather, they would explore any path that promised even the smallest glint of a credible answer, or what they would feel to be a credible answer. This ancient view of the process of discovery was best summed up by the Roman orator and statesman Quintus Simmanicus when he said, "The heart of so great a mystery can never be reached by following one road only." Thanks to the internet, we're now learning amazing new things about our ancient civilizations and their inventions. We're also learning that they viewed the universe as an open system. Instead of our modern mechanistic view, they saw the universe as what we would call a biological system, one in which we are but an integral part of an ever-evolving cosmos. And of all the ancient civilizations we've studied, the one that examined the very cosmological questions of our day with definitive results were the ancient Egyptians. In the first book of the Colbran Bible, which was written some 3,600 years ago by the Egyptians, they answer these modern-day questions for us, not in their context, but in ours. And in this audio program, I'm going to share with you my view of their answers in layman's terms, and best of all, you do not have to spend a penny to read this actual source material. Visit Colbran.com, K-O-L-B-R-I-N.com, and download any of the freely available Look Inside demo files. All of the passages discussed in this audio are in those demo files. So you might want to take a moment to pause this program and download one of these free demo files before proceeding on to our answer to the core question of this program. Did the Big Bang create God? This whole issue of cosmology really came onto the radar scope for me back in the 80s with the Challenger disaster. NASA's space shuttle program had become so commonplace that America just expected it to work as it always had. It didn't, and we lost the crew and the craft in a tragic accident. I can now say that this tragic day also shaped a tenuous connection between the Colbran Bible, the Challenger disaster, and the Space Hubble telescope that I would only discover until many years later. A month before the Challenger disaster, I had begun freelancing for the Cable News Network as a science features field producer. My beat included the major universities in Texas, and I was also free to sniff about the state for other possible stories. And that was when I set my sights squarely on the Hubble Space Telescope, which at that time was scheduled for launch in 1986. This was an irresistible story for me because the Johnson Space Center, as in Houston, Tranquility Base here, the Eagle has landed, was in my backyard, so to speak. Regrettably, the Challenger disaster pushed back the launch date from 1986 to 1990. By that time, I'd already been working in the Silicon Valley area as a computer consultant for about a year. So when the Hubble was eventually launched, I missed out on the story. But I stayed interested, and I continued following it, because once you get the cosmological itch, you spend the rest of your life scratching. At the time the Hubble launched in 1990, cosmologists were still estimating the age of our universe to be somewhere between 10 and 20 billion years. So what's the difference between a few billion years here and there? Everything. And this was one of the principal reasons for building the Hubble Space Telescope in the first place, because we needed to know if the universe is expanding outward or collapsing back on itself. If the Hubble told us that the universe is relatively young towards the 10 billion years side of the scale, then we'd know it has enough mass to continue expanding outward. Conversely, if our universe is relatively old towards the 20 billion years side of the scale, then it lacks the mass needed to continue expanding and will eventually collapse back upon itself. Should that happen, then the wondrous firmament we now behold will, in time, slowly disassemble itself into noble gases and carbon compounds, then, with ever-increasing speed, squeeze itself back into a simple singularity, a hot, dense, and featureless singularity we can only imagine with abstract numbers and formulas, and even those fail us. This takes us back to Quintus Semanicus, when he said, "The heart of so great a mystery can never be reached by following one road only." So let's take another road. The road of human imagination. Back in 1980, the whole issue of cosmology hit the mainstream with Carl Sagan's show, The Cosmos. And this miniseries, which was broadcast on television, was phenomenal. It fired our imagination, and it riveted us to this topic. And to do it, Sagan used the spaceship of the mind. And in this marvelous spaceship, we went places and did things that we had never imagined before. So, to help us frame the issue of whether the universe is expanding or contracting in human terms, let's use one of Carl Sagan's most favored old haunts in Northern California, a place called Seacliff State Beach. It's located at the north end of the Monterey Bay in California, and its long, broad pier is capped by an old, broken concrete ship made back in World War I. When Sagan was alive, fishermen would walk out to the edge of the pier and onto this old ship and go right out to the bow and drop their fishing lines in the water. Since then, the ship has broken apart and is no longer safe to walk on. So it has become a safe haven for huge flocks of seabirds that entertain the countless families that trek from near and far to enjoy the beach's sand and surf on warm summer days. The perfect combination for children and sandcastles. Now let's imagine we're strolling the beach, as Sagan often did, and we come upon a toddler. Waddling along with a receding wave, she steps cautiously up to the water's edge. Behind her stands an attentive grandfather, beaming with joy as he experiences his beloved grandchild's first day at the beach. Standing rigid against the first wave as it rushes up around her legs and up onto the beach, she is resolute. Even though the experience startles her a little bit, she senses a connection that overcomes her flight instinct. Then comes the second wave. She stares in awe at the foam rushing about her legs, and as the water returns back into the sea, she feels the sand giving way under her feet. Now she's curious beyond fear. There is a connection here that must be explored, and so she takes a few hesitant steps forward to meet the next oncoming wave. This time, the connection clicks, and the glee on her face is unmistakable. It says, "Gaia, Earth Mother, I get it, I get it." We nod at the grandfather. "You must live for days like these," we say. He gives us a quick look over his shoulder and winks back with a wide grin. He knows his granddaughter will forget some or even all of the experience, but yet for him, it is an indelible moment in time, a celebration of her young life and purpose, as well as that for all those who came before her and those yet to follow in her footsteps. In such a gentle exploration, none can be forgotten, for indeed, it is truly a timeless day. Waving goodbye, we ramble down the beach and come upon a happy, noisy family building a huge sandcastle. They know the evening's high tide will wash up and carry their sandcastle away. But that's okay. Actually, more than okay. It is one of the wonderful things about sandcastles. That connection you feel as you slap wet sand into shape You know that millennia ago, ancient creatures laid their eggs on this very beach, back when humanity was taking its early steps and when men would leave their families on the relative safety of the beach to go out on hunts. They knew that if a predator threatened the encampment, their families could flee into the water and find some safety there. So in a very real sense, these sands contain the residual molecules of all those who have come before our present-day castle builders. In the future, there will be other sandcastle builders, and beyond them, life forms yet to be imagined. That evening, when the dark waters of high tide wash up upon the beach, the sandcastle will be washed away like a Tibetan sand painting. And all that remains is an ongoing celebration of life. There is a wonderful sense of peace and continuity in that. To know that even though we fade into dust, our molecules will eventually combine with future lives in an infinite celebration of life. That is, assuming our universe continues expanding on into infinity. And if not, what happens then? If the universe collapses back upon itself, there will be no more timeless moments on the beach with our sandcastles to remember, because time as we know it will cease to exist. Likewise, the celebration of life will no longer be infinite, and our enduring molecules of uniqueness and life will be thoughtlessly disassembled by an unfeeling physical force. Then one day, even that will be forced back into a featureless singularity that perhaps could be the genesis of yet another Big Bang. Or not. And if so, what about God? From our first remembrances, we're told that God made us in His own image. If the Bible is correct, then we, carbon-based life forms, were made in the image of a carbon-based God, or at least one that is partly made of carbon. And this, then, presents us with a perplexing conundrum. Before the Big Bang, the universe, as we know it today, was packed inside an unimaginable singularity, one that did not even contain a whisper of carbon, which is the basis of our planet's biology. With the Big Bang came the beginning of time and the universe. As the simple hydrogen gases spread outward, more complex forms of hydrogen appeared, and this grew into the stuff of stars. As these early stars cast their light into a lifeless universe, they grew old, and in the death throes of their supernovas, they created the stuff of which we're made. Carbon. Therefore, we do not exist as a result of the Big Bang, but rather as the residue of billions of stars that have died since the Big Bang. Ergo, if we as post-Big Bang carbon beings were created in the image of a carbon god, then when the universe collapses back upon itself, we cease to exist. But so does God. Can this really be God's fate? Consider, our scientific observations of life has shown us that the essence of life is to exist. So in that sense, it couldn't be God's fate. But then again, every unique life form, self-aware or not, must reproduce in order to survive. And when their environment changes beyond their ability to adapt, they become extinct. In simple terms, if God is made up of dead star stuff like those whom He created, then that means He too was created by the Big Bang. And should the universe collapse in upon itself, God's environment will change beyond His ability to adapt, and He too will become extinct. Therefore, the inescapable conclusion of a collapsing universe is undeniable. God dies. That is, if and only if the universe does collapse back upon itself, and we still do not have a solid answer to that question. In fact, cosmologists willingly state that we understand but 1% of the universe with any sense of absolute certainty. And so this brings us to the 99% question, and it's the longest question you'll ever hear. If the other 99% of the universe is the same as the 1% we do know, and the universe really does lack the mass to continue expanding, and God is partly carbon-based and will die like those he created, and so perhaps misery loves company more than a noble purpose, and all our timeless moments on the beach are consequently wasted, like the finite commingling of our molecules with other future species, then who shall be there to listen when we last ask, "Is that all there is?" Which also happens to be the title of a Peggy Lee song that goes back to 1969.
Is that all there is? Is that all there is? If that's all there is, my friends, then let's keep dancing. Let's break out the booze and have a ball. If that's all there is,
but what if there's more? There could be more. Lots more. Time for us to dust off the December 1998 issue of Science Magazine. After its launch on April 25, 1990, the Hubble Space Telescope disappointed the world with out-of-focus pictures that really focused a lot of heat on NASA. And so, in 1993, they sent the Space Shuttle Endeavour into space to capture the ailing Space Observatory and repair it. If the Hubble had been a game of roulette, NASA bet the farm on double zero and won on the second spin. The images came pouring in with stunning clarity, and we had the answers to questions that had so long plagued us. What we learn is our universe is relatively young. And not only that, we also learned it is expanding faster than we had originally thought. 1998 was also a year of big political scandals, and this phenomenal piece of news had to compete with all that noise. So while the popular press was captivated by scandals and human foibles, scientists were riveted to the cover of the December issue of Science Magazine. It featured a delightful caricature of Albert Einstein, and the title read, "The Accelerating Universe, Breakthrough of the Year." That headline said it all. With that, the findings started coming in rapid succession. First were the astronomers at the University of California and the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. They told us that not only is our universe expanding, but it is expanding at an ever-quickening pace. An observation that was then echoed by NASA's Hubble Space Telescope team. So given that our universe is relatively young and that it's not only expanding, but expanding at an ever-quickening pace, will the universe continue to expand indefinitely? Ask any cosmologist and the best answer you'll get is a maybe. But at least science has gone from God is certain to die when the universe collapses to God will most likely live if current trends persist. So for now, the best we can hope for is that Science Magazine is still in print sometime around the end of time. In the meantime, we still need to ask a new question. Given our universe is to be somewhere between 12 to 14 billion years old, according to NASA's estimate, and that, according to the scientists at Berkeley, it's expanding at an ever-increasing rate, that brings us to an obvious question. Why? Our best answer at present is found in a concept Albert Einstein once described as his biggest blunder. It implies that most of the energy of the cosmos is contained in empty space, and it is very different from the energy we use to power our industrialized world. This energy is part of what we call observable matter, and it only represents about 4% of the universe. So what about the other 96%? Well, to paraphrase George Bernard Shaw's keen observation of economists, if all cosmologists were laid end to end, they would not reach a conclusion. Keeping this in mind, let's take a simple view of the unobservable. According to current estimates, approximately 24% of the universe is what we call dark matter. Like observable matter, dark matter has mass. However, dark matter cannot be measured with present-day technologies because it does not reflect light or emit light as does observable matter. Consequently, we can only know of its existence by virtue of its interaction with observable matter, which we do know. So, let's do the math. Let's see, we got 4%, 24%, well, that comes up to 28%. We've only accounted for 28% of the universe. What about the other 72%? Cosmologists call it dark energy, and it is the most mysterious and abundant component of our universe. Unlike dark matter that can only be deduced because of the way it interacts with observable matter, dark energy, on the other hand, can only be deduced because of the way it counteracts gravity, the cosmic glue that holds our universe together. Cosmologists tell us that dark energy explains why our universe is expanding at an ever-increasing rate. It is pushing our universe outward against the force of gravity that is simultaneously trying to pull the universe back into another featureless pre-Big Bang singularity. Since we know so very little about dark energy, who is to say how it will behave in the future, and whether or not it will continue to push against the force of gravity? Humanity may never be able to fully understand dark energy with the same ease as counting one's fingers and toes, which, in a manner of speaking, is a simplified explanation of the scientific process. The core belief of science that if we cannot observe a phenomena with our human senses or through a device that reliably extends the reach of those senses, such as hearing aids, eyeglasses, or telescopes, then it doesn't exist. Rather, it is simply an unsolved mystery that makes us shake our heads while we contemplate the design for yet another device to extend our limited senses. All this sounds plausible and proper until you ask any cosmologist to calculate how much of the cosmos we do understand. The answer will be 1% for most, if not all. Given that it has taken humanity all this time to figure out just 1% of the cosmos, how many of us will be around when scientists reach a full consensus about the other 99%. And so we come back again to Semanicus. The heart of so great a mystery can never be reached by following one road only. If we take his words to heart and allow ourselves the freedom to travel a different road, what might we find at the heart of this great mystery? Perhaps a journey to oneness with our Creator. For those of us fortunate enough to live in a dwelling place with private bedrooms, there is an unwritten rule. The head of household and spouse get the master bedroom. Kids and the guests are given the smaller rooms. So what if God's master bedroom also happens to be the dark energy of the universe, or even the cosmological body of God, our Creator, and the Creator of all that exists? With this question in mind, let's open our Colburn Bible and go back in time, about 3,600 years, to what the ancient Egyptians told us in the Book of Creation 1:5. He who preceded all existed alone in his strange abode of uncreated light, which remains ever inextinguishable, and no understandable eye can ever behold it. And what it tells us is that the ancients knew God existed prior to the Big Bang, in what we now call the Dark Force. And what do we know about the Dark Force? It is the greatest part of all there is, and yet it will always elude us for as long as we hold fast to our need to prove all that there is with our 5 physical senses. So does this mean that God existed in an unimaginable nothingness devoid of time and dimension? If so, it's no wonder he wanted company. But then again, how are we to know the mind of God? But we can know the stars and heavens above. When the ancient Egyptians first penned the earliest passages of the Colburn Bible, they used an ancient hieratic that was later translated into Phoenician and then on to Old English, which was finally updated into Continental English in the years following World War I. This is the version of the Colburn Bible that is now published by Your Own World Books. And in Creation 1:5, we find an interesting aspect of this translation. So let me read it for you. The pulsating draughts of the eternal lifelight in his keeping were not yet loosed. It's interesting to note their usage of the term draughts, which is chiefly British, and it was used correctly. This is because the term draughts is an apt description for our spiral and circular galaxies and galaxy clusters. Hence, the ancient Egyptians, through translation by the Phoenicians and the Celts, are telling us that these draughts had not been loosed, and so these circular-shaped heavenly bodies were held captive within a pre-Big Bang singularity, which contained within it all the matter and energy of space. Given all of that, why unloose it? Could it be because God was lonely? Let's take a look at that. The term Big Bang tends to make us think of the creation event as a conventional explosion when, for all we know, it could have been a big dribble instead of a Big Bang. Nonetheless, it was an event that filled space with all of the particles needed to create an embryonic universe. Cosmologists can describe what happened after the Big Bang in rather confident terms. As to what existed prior to the Big Bang, they offer possibilities glued together with highly uncertain caveats. On the other hand, the ancient Egyptians offer a more certain view. In Creation 1:5, they tell us, "He knew himself alone. He was uncontrasted, unable to manifest in nothingness, for all within his being was unexpressed potential." What the ancient Egyptians were really telling us through this first book of the Colburn Bible is that the singularity that was to become our universe was, as they call it, an unexpressed potential, and therefore it was but one small part of God. And of even greater importance, God was sufficiently self-aware to feel loneliness. So if we can set aside the Big Bang mental image of a violent explosion, we are then free to imagine God realizing that the path to companionship and self-expression could be achieved through the release of a singularity. Given that this Big Bang is really still playing itself out, is it going the way God intended? And knowing this beforehand, was he hesitant to create something that could evolve from a Big Bang into a big mistake? In Creation 1:6, the ancient Egyptians hint at this possibility when they say, "The great circles of eternity were yet to be spun out, to be thrown forth has the endless ages of existence in substance. If one's motive is pure loneliness, then that would make sense in a very human way, because we use human attributes to describe God. He's loving, vengeful, angry, and rather judgmental. However, what the ancients tell us is that God does not act like a human. God acts like a creator, and that God made the conscious decision to do it right the first time. And where do they say this? For that we look to the last sentence of Creation 1:6. There, they answer our question by telling us exactly what will happen with all of the galaxies and galaxy clusters in our universe. It reads, "They were to begin with God and return to Him complete in infinite variety and expression." Yes, in just 16 simple yet very pithy words, the Colburn Bible gives us the most vital answer imaginable. So let me read those 16 words to you again. They were to begin with God and return to Him complete in infinite variety and expression. The message here is strikingly clear. God, by intention, triggered the Big Bang to create time, dimension, space as we know it, so that our cosmos could grow and evolve with infinite variety and expression. Now let's contrast that ancient understanding with what we think we know today. Cosmologists are still undecided about the possibility that our universe will eventually expand to a point where it lacks the necessary mass to counteract gravity and consequently collapse back in upon itself. Assuming that happens, and all that there is to return to God in the form of a singularity, then where is all of the infinite variety and expression in all that? Because a singularity is simply that, a singularity. If we choose to believe the wisdom of the ancients as it was written some 3,600 years ago in the Colburn Bible, our universe is expanding, and it will continue to expand. Despite the fears of some, it will not collapse back into a featureless singularity that leaves us singing, "Is that all there is?" Rather, it will continue to expand into other expanding universes because we are but one part of an ever-evolving multiverse. When you stop to consider that simple yet all-encompassing thought, the next question that comes to your mind is, if we're still trying to find this answer, how did they find it 3,600 years ago? Where did the knowledge come from? And that's a marvelous question because after the Exodus, the Egyptians began looking for clues that would lead them to the one true God of Abraham. And they interviewed the wisest of the wise everywhere within their trading realm to compile this anthology of wisdom. So we're not sure if it came from them or someone else. It might be interesting to think about the possibility that the survivors of ancient civilizations such as Lemuria or Atlantis found their way to the Middle East, and that the wisest of their wise contributed their words of wisdom to this marvelous historical work. One that is filled with incredible wisdom that speaks to you in the context of your own life experience. Had it not been for my interest in the Hubble Space Telescope while I was doing features for CNN, I would not have taken an interest in cosmological matters. And I would not have found the answer sitting right in front of me when I opened the Colburn Bible and read the very first few pages. I had an answer to a question that had been rattling around in my head for a long time, and it felt right. It fit, just like that last piece in the puzzle that just snaps right into place as perfect as you please. And that's what timeless wisdom is really like. It fits. When it does, you do not need some high-priced expert to tell you it fits. You know, right in your gut, that's what I was looking for. And those are the kinds of experiences you will have with the Colburn Bible. And I'm sure that each of you listening to this, as you begin reading this ancient work, will find things that reach out to you and answer your questions in ways you could have never imagined. For the Colburn Bible, this is Marshall Masters.
We thank you for listening to this special presentation by Marshall Masters, a former CNN Science feature producer and the publisher of the Colburn Bible. You can learn more about this 3,600-year-old secular wisdom text at colburn.com. That's K-O-L-B-R-I-N.com.